Welcome back to our Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today with Dr. Eden Fromberg, who's a DO, an osteopathic physician, who is the medical director at Soho OBGYN. Are you the medical director there?
I just have my practice.
Well, you have your practice at Soho OBGYN. Yeah. Okay. And but is the founding director of Lila Yoga, Dharma, and Wellness. We'll talk a little bit about that, where she teaches and curates bio-intelligent movement and yoga for women. And that also involves some prenatal care as well, and care for women who are pregnant. And we were discussing during the break between our podcasts, your background as a DO, as an osteopathic physician, kind of uniquely prepared you for this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in obstetrics, and the connection between OBGYN and osteopathic medicine isn't always clear. You know, somebody might have a kink in their neck, a pregnant woman might have trouble breathing because
back pain or something.
Kind of stuff. Yeah, so I would help people with their little adjunct issues as it came up. But when it really became valuable was when I started to get into treating women with complex gynecological issues such as vulvar, pelvic, and sexual pain, because these women, it's not something that the regular gynecologists understand. It's certainly not something that I was trained in as part of my conventional GYN training. And I'm a member of the International Pelvic Pain Society, the International Society for the Study of Vulvovaginal Diseases, and other societies of that regard, and we meet several times a year and talk about innovations in the field. And because this isn't a field that's really already happening clinically, let's say, it's like really people who are sub-specializing in it, there isn't a lot of direction, guidance, clinical protocols, and guidelines already in place. We're sort of creating them. And so I'm able to look at my patients really as individuals and personalize their care in very innovative ways that are quite effective. And so the issue of vulvar, pelvic, and sexual pain, it's really often about neurology and connective tissue and not about the things that gynecologists are typically looking for.
So it's not just a yeast infection or something. You know,
right. So typically women will come and they have certain types of symptoms, and those symptoms, depending on what they are often interpreted as a yeast infection, some kind of a vaginitis, or possibly, you know, there'll be ultrasounds and CAT scans and things done to look for various pelvic masses or cysts. But when none of that is coming up as positive, or when the repetitive treatment of yeast, which could go on for 2 years, sometimes even 10 years, isn't working, obviously these women need to be served by some other tactic as opposed to telling them that it's all in their head or it's crazy or it's psychological, because even if it is, there should be a way to care for them, right?
Well, in other words, on an exam, if you say it's neurological in many cases, you could do an exam and look inside there and the tissue looks perfectly normal, but the woman might be experiencing pain, which is sometimes ascribed to, well, that's a psychological thing. You know, maybe you've got, you're a little bit hypochondriacal.
Yeah, that could be. It's often dismissed. I think that women are almost expected, and often themselves expect, to live with a certain degree of pain, discomfort, and problems vulvovaginally and in the pelvic area. And it's actually not true. There is a lot of potential help and treatment, and I take a more integrative and holistic perspective, but I can also talk a little bit about some of the other techniques, which, you know, being holistic to me means all the Botox injections and trigger point injections, if that's what you really need. But typically my patients don't need that, because I try to take a much more functional approach. So diagnostically, what I'm finding is usually there's some pelvic floor muscle spasm. The patient is often not aware of that. There may often be hip problems that are associated, that are tracking through the pelvic floor. There may be pudendal neuralgia or ilioinguinal nerve compression or other issues with the nerves. And there may even be autonomic nervous issues that have more to do with, if somebody has more than, let's say, three yeast infections, she may actually grow new nerve endings that are kind of highly interesting.
Become like hypersensitized or something like that?
Yeah, like a hypervigilant. So it's not just the brain thinking, do I have yeast? Do I feel itchy? It's like the nerves are doing it on a subconscious level for you. So there are many, many treatments, such as using lidocaine, intravaginal Valium, pelvic floor physical therapy. I personally do a lot of gynecological visceral manipulation, and there's trigger point injections with natural substances like vitamin B12 or even homeopathic Tramiol that we can do.
Do you ever use there is a diet that we sometimes prescribe for vulvodynia. It doesn't always work, but sometimes it does work brilliantly. It's the low oxalate diet. Do you find that that sometimes can help?
Yeah. Interestingly, I used to use that diet a lot. I found that it was pretty variable if I would get any positive results with it, and it's sort of been debunked. So I may speak with people about it, but it doesn't seem to be the main issue for most people, because it's not like the chemical insult is really the issue when the nerves are, in a state. Like, if there's nerve fibrosis or compression, I don't know that the low oxalate diet would really address that.
Right. Right.
I think it depends on what the underlying issue is. So for the people where it is more biochemical, that might benefit them.
Absolutely. And so this is a pretty common problem. What's your take on breastfeeding? Because you write frequently about that. I read one of your blogs recently on the subject. You think that obviously this plays a very, very important part in mother and child bonding.
I think that breastfeeding is really important from many perspectives, but I also feel the need to say that no woman should feel guilty if she hasn't breastfed her child. But there is a lot of misinformation out there. I will just come right out and say that there are, in fact, formula companies that pay bloggers to write articles that are negative about breastfeeding or that write negative comments, such as calling breastfeeding mothers the breaststoppo and how they just fling it out.
Lactation Nazis, I've heard that term.
Right, and actually some of those terms were coined by bloggers who were being paid by infant formula companies. Hmm. This has been exposed. So, yeah, Fonterra in New Zealand. So that has to be considered in terms of how we as society view breastfeeding, because it's actually very strange to me that there should be any negativity about the most biologically obvious way that every mammal feeds their young, and that women should be able to feed their babies without worrying about it in any setting. In fact, there are laws that support women's rights to do that, but there's still a lot of discomfort, because the fact is breastfeeding is the healthiest way to feed a baby. There is no doubt about it that the moment that another milk, such as a cow milk or a formula, touches the gut lining of the baby, there are immediately alterations that start to take place. And the importance of the baby's immune system being seeded by the microbiome is then supported after birth by breastfeeding and colostrum and all of the immunoglobulins that are living immune factors that the mother is providing for the baby. And you just can't get that in a baby formula. And they're always finding, oh, we should have put chloride in the formula. Oh, we should have put this in. Oh, shoot, there was too much bacteria in the processing plant. Let's recall it. All of these things are, to me, somewhat scary. I think that breastfeeding is definitely the preferred method, but I also realize that these people need to do different things for different reasons in the modern world, and no one should feel judged or guilty.
Indeed. But also, lately, it's emerged that not only are there tremendous benefits for and advantages for the baby, but also for the mother. So can you get into that a little bit?
Well, there is a highly reduced breast cancer risk, especially with breastfeeding at a younger age. If a mother breastfeeds for 18 months or more, there are significant benefits in terms of reduced breast cancer. The baby and the mother also will bond because, mother's holding the baby. There's a lot of skin-to-skin contact. The baby's being exposed to the bacteria on the mother's skin, which is actually very healthy for the baby. So breastfeeding has multiple benefits to both mother and baby, and definitely reduction of breast cancer. In the modern world, with breast cancer rates now approaching 1 in 7 women, we take all that we can get to reduce that risk.
Does it do anything for the woman's psyche? I think there's something about oxytocin being released in the act
of
breastfeeding.
Yeah, so in terms of the bonding, I can speak more about that. So what happens when the baby latches onto the breast, there's a natural release of oxytocin, which immediately after birth is beneficial because it helps the uterus kind of cramp down, which is uncomfortable, yes, but it helps prevent bleeding and hemorrhage and helps bring the uterus back to its normal size. But oxytocin is also the hormone of love and attachment, and so that natural oxytocin release that happens whenever the baby is latched onto the breast creates a sense of love and attachment and good feelings between the mother and baby. But that oxytocin, no doubt, is infusing her entire being and giving her a very yummy, lovey sense. I mean, many mothers describe a birth high, they even call it, for a few weeks after they give birth, and many delicious sensations.
So it's something not to be dreaded. It's something to be welcomed and, if possible, implemented. Talk a little bit about your, you know, you have sort of a dual professional persona because on the one hand, you're a DO, you're a medical doctor in practice, but also you have a dual role because you instruct women and I think probably both sexes in yoga and movement therapies. How does that tie into your medical work?
Yeah, so I have a yoga and movement studio. We call it Leela Yoga, Dharma, and Wellness. It's on the Bowery. And initially, we were doing a lot of prenatal yoga. That was about 11 years ago. And we still have a very robust prenatal yoga program, prenatal yoga teacher training. But as
so certain things, certain positions you do and certain positions you eschew in pregnancy, right?
Absolutely. Like, let's say you don't do bow pose where all of the body weight is right flat
right.
in the belly.
Right.
You just don't do that. But there are other more subtle modifications that we certainly teach people. And in terms of the rest of the movement, I've really tried to develop something different because I feel like most women who are having these pelvic, vulvar, and sexual pain issues are told, in fact, by physical therapists and other doctors to just stop doing yoga or Pilates or whatever they are doing because the way that they're approaching the practice is damaging and is, in fact, exacerbating compensatory patterns in their tissues that almost make it worse. So, but not moving is no good because not moving, nothing gets to change
yep.
ever. It just sits there in its state of being unwell. And so what I'm doing is having people come in who are doing more what I would call feminine types of movement. And it's not even in a way that people expect. It's not just belly dance class.
Right. Pole dancing instruction.
Yeah, nothing like that. It's continuum movement. It's somatics. It's things that have more to do with the spiraling and undulating movements of the body as opposed to simply the more mechanistic or linear movements of the body, which even yoga has a lot of that. And doing classes that do yoga in a different way, where it's, let's say, combined with continuum movement or taught by a Rolfer who has certain views about the structure of the body. And so it's really finding ways that women can connect and be empowered, even if they're sick, if they have autoimmune disease, if they have cancer, if they have pelvic floor disorder. Here's a place that they can come and find community and find the types of classes that can help them move and find joyful embodiment without feeling like it's some sort of a competitive yoga class where they have to look glamorous and perform and do vinyasa and chaturangas. It's not for everyone. And certainly yanking your foot all the way to the back of your head in pigeon when you have a pelvic floor disorder can cause all sorts of trouble.
So absolutely. It's about enhancing function and not to look good naked, necessarily.
Well, yeah. The way that I would put it is how can you use the structure of your body to enhance the function of your organs and glands instead of using the structure of your body to just feel a certain way while you're in a class and look a certain way after class that may not feel very good later. Yeah. A lot of people come with aches and pains and injuries, and a lot of the hip stuff that's going on in yoga is tracking into pelvic floor disorders because this whole concept of opening your hips is very misguided, I think. Opening the heart, opening the hips, that's really not what needs to be going on there. There needs to be structure, support, containment, and proper use. I mean, if the hips are opening at the wrong angle, what's good about that? Nothing.
Well, that's great because that really is kind of harkening back to the origins of yoga, which is actually not to make individuals look muscular or shredded or buff or even physically strong, but it was designed as a healing art, as a way of as a scientific method of enhancing organ function.
Yeah, and I think that the approach to yoga of really going into internal practices and inner awareness is very, very important, but that's often what gets bypassed in modern yoga. It's really just become a physical
like a yoga aerobics thing kind of.
Yeah, and with that, and this is part of why so many people I think are getting injured in yoga class. I mean, think about it. People
right.
sit in chairs a lot as part of their normal work day. They don't squat, which is a weight bearing thing for the hips. So squatting, it opens up the pelvic floor, it puts the weight into the hips, but most people aren't doing that. They're in the chair. So their psoas muscles, the muscles of fight or flight, are at half mast all day long, and then they go to a yoga class and now they're trying to manipulate themselves into all different different positions for only an hour and a half a day, it's not always a good combination. The tissues are not prepared for it. The tissues are training for what they spend the most time doing. So if you spend your day sitting in a chair, that's what the tissues are being trained for. And it's really a recipe for a lot of problems with hips, pelvic floor, and low back, just to name a few.
Yeah, I think I exemplify some of those characteristics, having been a doctor in practice for 30 years plus. So,
stand workstation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or people who sit in a ball, or you know, one of those.
Yeah, I have a swapper chair. It's sort of shaped like a meditation cushion, and it's on a spring, so it gives me some more mobility and lets my spine kind of move around, which I think is also important.
No, people think I'm weird enough already, I think, so I may have to, you know, don the usual coat and tie and sit in the Aeron chair for the time being.
Yeah, I let it all go, Ron.
You're out there.
I'm weird. There's nothing I can do about it.
You're way out of the closet on that one, for sure. You let your colors fly. But tell us a little bit about, in the concluding moments of our interview, your international work, because I think that's a big part of what energizes you and also informs your practice as you go hither, thither, and yon, and you assist in birthing practices and help women in far-flung parts of the world.
Yeah, I'm really, really passionate about the work that I do, particularly in Bali, Indonesia, with Robin Lim. She won the CNN Hero Award in 2011, and I couldn't think of somebody who deserves it more than she does, because the project, when I was first involved in the late 90s, we were just kind of working out of a loft up, near her kitchen, and now she's got a whole clinic built, and I think they're expanding the clinic now, and they want some hospital facilities. And I feel like it's a great model for gentle childbirth, because women can go to Bali and have babies in water with flower petals, with people chanting the Gayatri mantra, which is, you know, a Hindu chant that the Balinese like to chant when they have babies. And it's a very different experience than, let's say, in New York with a high-tech environment. And I've actually had women who have had several C-sections and felt very traumatized by that, looking at pictures of childbirth in Bali and saying, I could have had a better birth in Bali. And then they'll start to cry because they realize that that level of compassion and gentle welcoming of the baby into the world and being kind to the mother is something that they really missed having as part of their childbirth experiences. So I love the work that I do in Bali, because poor people who would otherwise somewhat be abused in hospital settings because they really can't afford that kind of care anyway and are not treated well in those environments are being given amazing care. And then we can use this to have a model, even with statistics of good outcomes, to show people in more industrialized countries, hey, you can do this. And as we do development projects throughout the world, in Africa and Asia, we can use this as a positive model for change and give women good hospital and childbirth experiences, as opposed to sometimes the way that it goes, where people are literally abused in labor or have their babies held hostage in wards until the bill is paid.
Right. Well, the entire process is dehumanizing. And there's probably all of about two malpractice lawyers on the entire island of Bali. So that may change the the climate for
You know
for
what?
Birth.
If a baby dies, the family usually would bring fruit and thank us for doing all that we could, because they would know that we did, because we would have those types of relationships.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Let's get some information about your practice in Soho here in New York City.
Yeah, so you can read more about it on my website, which is DrEdenFromberg.com.
Could you spell it, please?
Yeah, so it's DrEdenFromberg.com.
It's phonetic.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then at Soho OBGYN, it's SOHOOBGYN.com. That's
two O's.
Medical practice.
Right.
Yeah. And then Lila Yoga, Dharma, and Wellness is the movement studio, and that's LILAYOGA. Actually, you know what? The website, we just call it Lila Wellness to make it easy. LILAWELLNESS.com.
If you Google LILA New York City, probably get there, right?
Probably, but LilaWellness.com. And then if people want to read more about Robin Lim and her projects, I think RobinLimSupport.com will probably get you there. And Yayasan Bumisahat is YayasanBumiSehat.
Well, that's fascinating. That's like medical tourism for pregnancy, right? Which is an amazing concept.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. I mean, we're really serving a lot of the local community there. But yeah, people do come from elsewhere now to have babies.
Fabulous. Well, I really been a pleasure getting to know you a little better via this interview and for our listeners to be exposed to your perspective. So I appreciate very much you joining us, Dr. Eden Fromberg. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.